Good morning, everybody. How are you doing? I'm good, thank you. So I hope you're ready with lots of questions today. Once you've woken up. Okay, so just to remind you where we are, we have this idea of a manifold, M. So this is some curved space, and it's going to have one time-like direction and three space-like directions at every point. And on that manifold is a metric, a G mu nu. The coordinates on the manifold are x, which I think David described to you. You can think of as just maps from the manifold, which is the concept you have in mind, to some flat Euclidean space. So the x are coordinates on the manifold. And these coordinates are arbitrary, and it's kind of one of the, yeah.
So when we're doing GR, we don't assume any topology for the manifold, right?
You can assume whatever topology you like.
Okay,
yeah. General relativity is a local theory. So it's just a theory of how the curvature of the manifold behaves in response to the matter present on the manifold and how the matter moves on the manifold. So we say, John Wheeler, who I had the good fortune to know, said matter tells spacetime how to curve and spacetime tells matter how to move. So we haven't put matter on it yet. We're about to do that. But it's one of the strange things about physics is that, well, about the world, is that we can have pictures of the world which are very vivid, like curved space-time, but we can't really describe those pictures without numbers. And as soon as we translate geometry into numbers, we end up doing algebra. And so even though the numbers themselves don't really mean too much, it's the relationships between the numbers which mean a lot. You know, in this room, I could choose to measure x, y, and z from that corner, or this corner, or that corner, according to my clock, or somebody's clock in Japan, or anybody else's clock. And our definitions of these numbers are always have a large degree of arbitrariness. But we have a picture that underneath all this is something whose description is not just the numbers. It has an existence itself. And so again and again in physics, you'll find this theme that we use numbers or vector potentials or fields to describe reality. But each of those has a redundancy, okay? That we don't really mean this field is a real thing. We don't really mean the vector potential is a real thing. It's the class of vector potentials related by, for example, gauge transformations or the class of coordinates which one could associate with the manifold and so on. So one always has to bear in mind that the actual description we're using is redundant, okay? Meaning there are many versions of the description that actually correspond to the same real thing. And we don't know how to do better than this. And in fact, the principle that the description is redundant is a very powerful principle. So that's the principle of general coordinate invariance, which says that whatever coordinates you use, providing you follow these rules, that the equations are written as tensors, the equations are valid in all coordinate systems. And that principle is actually a very profound guide to what are the right equations. So it's almost as if we have to describe reality in terms of numbers. We know that description is redundant. If we insist that the equations are the same in any one of those descriptions, that's a really powerful principle. And it restricts the form of equations which we can write down. And that's actually how Einstein discovered this theory of general relativity, by insisting that the coordinates were redundant. Okay, so we have this manifold. We have coordinates. We have so you can imagine a you can imagine a coordinate chart. Let's say that would be x, which is just a mapping from every point of the manifold into four-dimensional space. Associated with that coordinate chart is a metric, the metric you would use in that coordinate chart. But we can also have another coordinate chart which has a different set of coordinates, x prime, also mapping every point on the manifold to R4. And in general, these coordinate charts may have different regions in which they are valid. But wherever they overlap, they better agree. Okay. And so that's the underlying structure. And the way we make sure they agree is by always writing equations which are invariant under changing coordinates. And in that case, we're guaranteed that if an equation is valid in this chart, it's going to be valid in that chart. Okay, so let's consider a space-time curve. So this is a general topic. In fact, I'll do it over there because it won't get blocked. Okay, so one of the most fundamental structures you can put on a manifold is a curve. And so let's imagine our manifold, and now we imagine a curve on it. So within a particular coordinate chart, that curve is going to be represented by the function, the coordinates x, the four coordinates, being functions of a parameter, lambda. So we call this the parameter of the curve. And you can think of lambda as running along the curve and telling you where the curve is on the manifold. So obviously, I can have x mu of lambda or x prime mu of lambda. And these are two equivalent descriptions of the same curve. This x prime mu, of course, can be written as x prime mu of x alpha of lambda, right? Because you have, when you do a coordinate transformation, you define x prime mu to be some function of the old coordinates, okay? And so wherever the curve was in the old coordinates, this function tells you where it is in the new coordinates. The problem is that this is not a vector. Okay, the transformation, x mu itself is not a vector. Transformation from x mu to x prime mu is just some arbitrary function. It's not a vector. It's not related by that Jacobian matrix. Okay, but the tangent vector, dx prime mu, d lambda, which you can think of as the little arrow running along the curve, dx mu d lambda, okay, that is a vector. Because dx prime mu d lambda, how do I compute it? Well, I just differentiate this with respect to lambda, and that gives me the partial derivative dx alpha dx alpha d lambda. Okay, so i.e., psi mu, if I define psi mu to be dx mu d lambda, then psi prime mu, the tangent vector in the new coordinates, is dx prime mu dx alpha psi alpha. Okay, so the tangent vector you can think of as a vector, and we can try to write down an equation for this vector and insist that it is invariant under coordinate transformations. And so that's what we're going to do. Now, when you think of curves in space-time, we all follow a curve. I'm at some position now, but if I draw my position as a function of time, right? Then if I jump backwards and forwards, I'm going to be doing this. And if I say the same, and if I run at a constant velocity. So we're all following curves in space-time. That's what everything, every object in the world does. Are there any special curves? Okay, are there any curves which are more special than any other curves? So roughly speaking, you want to start by defining the simplest possible curve in space-time. So the simplest curves before I get to there, I actually want to use this curve to define parallel transport. Okay, so we've got a notion of a curve. Let's imagine I've got a vector. So a vector is some other object, which you can think of as having an arrow. So if I think of a vector in space-time, it would be like this. And the vector in space-time, or I could just have a vector on a curve. If I have a vector in space-time, that will define a vector at every point of the curve, on the curve, right? Or we can consider a vector just defined on the curve, v mu of lambda. Right? Just defined everywhere on the curve. So, for example, if you have a particle traveling through a medium like some water, you could say, what is the four velocity of the water as observed by the particle as it moves through space-time? Or you could say the particle carries a spin. Okay, particle carries with it a little vector. And that vector is only defined on the particle. It's not in the medium. But that spin would be literally carried by the particle. Okay, so this would be e.g. the spin of the particle. In fact, the spin is a tensor, but I won't get into that. So now let's define, when I have this vector, let's define, so we say a vector is parallel transported along a curve if, so roughly speaking, the idea is if the direction of the vector doesn't change. In fact, or neither the direction nor the length should change if this vector is kind of carried along the curve. And we say a vector is parallel transported along the curve if the following derivative, d lambda, this capital D is called the absolute derivative. And essentially, it's defined so that it is a vector. Okay, so I could do this. This would be d by d lambda v mu. Okay, so just like the derivative of a vector wasn't a vector, we had to correct it with a connection term to construct a vector. So when we differentiate this vector with respect to the parameter along the curve, we have to add a connection term, which goes like v alpha d x beta d lambda, and if this quantity. So this is a tensor. If this Well, it's actually a vector. It's also a vector, a four vector, a four vector, if this quantity is zero. So we say a vector is parallel transported along a curve if its derivative along the curve is zero. Yeah?
Is dp mu d lambda equal to dx beta d lambda nabla d mu?
Say again?
Is
you mean
the
capital D?
What?
The capital D or the small d?
The little d.
Oh, the little d. Here? Yes, absolutely. So let me put a little bit more detail in here. So in principle, this v mu need only be defined along the curve. Okay, so it doesn't need to know about the space-time. It just lives on the curve. Then this derivative, I just differentiate the v mu. And here, I've got to calculate gamma mu, alpha, beta, v alpha, oh. And that gamma is calculated at x nu of lambda. It's got to be calculated at the corresponding point on the curve. So if you know the value of lambda, you know the space-time coordinate, you know the connection at that space-time point, and that's what you've got to use in this equation. Okay, so then it's v alpha of lambda, and now it's now it's the tangent vector along the curve. And that entire quantity, as you can easily check, this entire quantity is indeed a four vector. Okay, so if the absolute derivative of a vector along a curve, if it is equal to zero, then we say that v is parallel transported along the curve. And you can think of that as just as literally meaning this is the closest you can get to saying that the vector is actually a constant along the curve. It's not a, you cannot, or another way of thinking about it, the vector at a point cannot easily be compared with a vector at another point. And the way to compare them is to use this parallel transport. So I take my original vector, I pull it along a curve, passing through the second point, and then I can compare the two vectors at the same space-time point. Yeah.
So to do this, the original vector need only be defined at a point, right? And then you extend it to a vector.
That's correct. Yes. So exactly. So given some vector at a point, I could propagate it along a curve. I can parallel transport it along some curve. So I literally think of this as I've got a flag, right? And somebody else has a flag in a different direction. And we're going to compare the two flags. The only way I can do it is by taking my flag over there. And this is one, this way of taking it over there, I can describe in terms which are independent of coordinates. Everybody will agree that if I follow the same curve in whichever coordinates I use, and then compare the vectors, we'll always get the same answers. Okay, so let's get back to this question of the simplest curve. So the simplest curves are geodesics. And the definition of a geodesic curve is that the absolute derivative of the tangent vector, okay, so we have some x mu of lambda, we have its tangent vector like this. And a curve is geodesic. A curve is geodesic if the absolute derivative of the tangent factor is equal to, so I imagine I work out the tangent vector along the curve, and then I try to parallel or transport the tangent vector. And if the tangent vector, if the absolute derivative of the tangent vector is proportional to the tangent vector, then we say it's a geodesic curve. Basically, it's the closest thing you can get to a straight line, right? What's special about a straight line? Well, if I move up and down the straight line, the direction of the line doesn't change, right? In this way of writing it, you don't actually care about the length of the tangent vector. All you care about is that you move it up and down the curve, it should be the tangent vector direction shouldn't change. Okay, so that's the definition of a geodesic curve. Now, it might look a little unfamiliar because you've got this funny function. Yeah?
You parallel transport a vector from one point to another point. But does its comparison to another vector at, say, point B depend on the curve along which you parallel transport?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So it depends on which curve you carry it along, what result you will get. And in fact, when this is one way to see that you have curvature of spacetime. If a spacetime is curved, and if I take a vector along two different curves and compare them, they won't agree. If a spacetime is, let's see, we can obviously do that with a sphere, right? So imagine I take, two vectors at the North Pole, right? One of them pointing in, and one of them pointing right, okay? And so this vector points in. Now I parallel transport it down to the equator along this curve, right? Well, let's just take one vector, yeah? And I parallel transport it down to the equator on this curve, it's going to be pointing up, right? I just drag this vector along that curve. Now let's do it a different way. Let's take this vector pointing in and drag it down to the equator here. Well, it's still pointing in, okay? And now I'm going to drag it around the equator to this guy. Well, it'll be here. Okay, so because I chose this curve to go on in the second option, I got a different result. And this is a very precisely related to the curvature of spacetime. That if when you go on different curves, you get different parallel transport, you can tell the spacetime is curved. Okay, good. Any other questions? Okay. So for a geodesic, the tangent vector is parallel to itself. That's all a geodesic means. Okay, it's a very simple definition. And what we'll see is that actually by choosing lambda, we can get rid of this term. Okay, so by changing, so if so, let me just say that in words, the tangent vector is always parallel to itself. And by that, I mean if I take it at one point and parallel transport it to the next point, it's still going to be, it'll be parallel to the value it has at the next point. Now, if so, okay, if a curve is geodesic, we can reparameterize the curve. Reparameterize just means pick a new lambda, the curve, so that f of lambda equals 0. Okay, so and when we do that, we'll get the famous geodesic equation. So let's change the parameter from lambda to some function of lambda. Okay? And we demand, if lambda was a good parameter, that means every point on the curve is in one-to-one correspondence with some value of lambda. If I reparameterize, I better insist that this sigma of lambda is monotonic in lambda, is monotonic. Okay, that just means it's a increasing function of lambda, so that for each value of lambda, there's only one value of sigma. Okay? And basically what that means is d sigma d lambda is always positive. So you better insist on that. And now let's just work out this equation, that equation. Let's work out this equation in the sigma coordinates. Okay, so then one, I'll call that equation one. One becomes d by d lambda of d sigma d lambda dx mu d lambda d sigma. So I'm just now thinking of so x of lambda. I'm thinking about this as x mu of lambda of sigma. Okay, and that I'm going to call x mu of sigma. So then d by d lambda of x is just d by d sigma times d sigma d lambda. And this plus gamma mu beta alpha dx beta d sigma dx alpha d sigma d lambda squared is equal to f of lambda d x mu d sigma d lambda. So that's just rewriting the equation in terms of sigma derivatives. Now, over here, we have d2 sigma d lambda squared dx mu d sigma. Then we have plus. So if I differentiate this guy with respect to lambda, that is d by d sigma of this guy multiplied by d sigma d lambda. So I get d sigma d lambda squared times d2x mu d sigma squared. Okay, that came from differentiating this term. Let's combine it with this term here. Gamma mu beta alpha dx beta d sigma dx alpha d sigma. And all of this is equal to a function of lambda d sigma d lambda times dx mu d sigma. And then you notice that if I choose sigma properly, I can get these two terms to cancel. So these cancel if d2 sigma d lambda squared equals f of lambda d sigma d lambda. Okay, but that's just, that's an easy differential equation to solve. Because that just says that d by d lambda of d sigma d lambda equals f of lambda d sigma d lambda. And so d sigma d lambda is an arbitrary constant times e to the integral f of lambda d lambda up to lambda. okay, with A an arbitrary constant. And so it's easy to arrange for these terms to cancel, and then the geodesic equation is just the middle term, just this term here, dx mu d sigma squared plus gamma mu alpha beta dx alpha dx beta d sigma equals 0. And we say, so this is called the geodesic equation. And sigma is called an affine parameter. Now, affine means that sigma is arbitrary. Affine, the word affine means that sigma is determined up to transformations of this form. Sigma prime is A sigma plus B with A and B constants. Okay, so it's obviously true in this equation that if I just rescale sigma, right, this involves two powers of sigma here. So rescaling sigma doesn't change anything, neither does translating sigma. And that translates back to the ambiguity in solving this equation. So the ambiguity in getting rid of this term on the right is precisely those two constants, A and B. And so we say what we've done here is rather nice. We've simplified the geodesic equation by choosing a particular kind of parameter along the curve, a parameter which is defined up to scale and translation. Okay, so every geodesic curve solves the geodesic equation with an appropriate affine parameter. And then it turns out in the universe, that's what particles do. They solve this equation. So if you follow a photon traveling through the universe, it follows the geodesic equation. Or if you follow a freely falling particle, if you drop a particle in the Earth's gravitational field, it follows that equation. So everything, so that's how space-time tells the matter how to move. Now, it's interesting also to see how the geodesic equation comes out of an action principle, because this is one of the great mysteries of physics, that all of the equations follow from variational principles, and the geodesic equation is no exception. So last time we did the action principle for a relativistic particle in flat space-time, and now we're going to generalize it and do it in curved space-time, and we'll see that it gives the geodesic equation. So the action for a particle moving in space-time. So the action is S. It's a variational principle. And what we discussed last time, or a few lectures ago, is that when one studies special relativity, we know this action must reduce to a half mv squared for a free particle in flat space. Okay? And then from that alone, we argued that the action has to take this form, integral d tau, where tau was the proper time along the proper time along the world line. I think there's a square here. So the particle is following some trajectory, some curve in space-time, x mu of tau, and tau is a parameter along the curve. And it will turn out that this proper time parameter is in fact an affine parameter. And the equation the particle follows is the geodesic equation in that parameterization. Okay, so here, so let's see, recall from special relativity. And now there's a perfect example of the equivalence principle that the I can write this, of course, as integral. I can write it this. Let's see. I can write it as square root of minus eta mu nu dx mu dx nu. Oh, I'm sorry. When I defined time, I think I had a c in there. That really is only one c. When I define proper time, it has the dimensions of time. I'm going to struggle to get my factors of c right, I can tell. Okay, here. So what is this? This is dt squared. This is c squared dt squared minus dx squared. And this becomes, the whole quantity becomes c dt square root 1 minus dx dt squared. Okay, so we argued that this must be the action for a relativistic particle because when I expanded the square root, I got minus a half v squared. And then there's a c squared over here, isn't there, by dimensions. And the c squareds will cancel. And so I'll get a half mv squared. And then I further argued, well, there seems to be an extra term, which is the mc squared integral dt. And I interpreted that as the potential energy associated with the particle. And from that, I got E equals mc squared. Now, I just want to show you this. As we pass to a general metric, I want to dwell on it a little bit and really prove to you that E equals mc squared, okay, in a formal way, which of course, will generalize to curved space-time as well. So the equivalence principle. So the equivalence principle basically says, well, it says that the laws of physics in a curved space-time must be exactly the same as they were in a flat space-time, okay, within any small neighborhood. So as far as this particle is concerned, it sees this metric, eta mu nu. But eta mu nu just becomes g mu nu at a point, okay? And so the action for a particle in a curved spacetime is just given by minus mc integral minus g mu nu dx mu. And I'll parameterize it now. Let's pick some parameterization, doesn't matter what. So I'll call it lambda, I guess. d lambda. Notice that the d lambdas cancel in that expression, so it doesn't really matter what parameterization I chose, as long as it's a good one. And so that is your guess. That is the guess inspired by the equivalence principle. I just take the special relativistic laws and replace the Minkowski metric with the curved space metric. And that will actually guarantee that the two laws agree in a local neighborhood. Okay, so let me just dwell on this a little bit before we go ahead and work out the equations of motion and show it's a geodesic equation. Let me show you that E equals mc squared really does follow from this equation. And this will be a nice excuse for me to bring in Noether's theorem, which is something you will encounter everywhere in this course. So aside, y e equals mc squared, and y momentum is conserved, and other things are not grammatical. Okay, let me get rid of that. Are conserved. So that is Noether's theorem. M.E. Noether discovered why there are constants in physics, like energy, momentum, electric charge, angular momentum, all these other things. And I want to show it to you from this action, and I want to show why that implies that E equals mc squared. Yep.
The equation on the second mode.
Okay.
The second term.
This one?
Yes. How do you get the phi squared for? Because I got that, and you just get the phi sigma out, and then you squared.
Sorry. Which step is confusing you? Here? How did I get it from there? Okay, so I took that term and I did d by d lambda. First I differentiated the d sigma d lambda to get this d2 sigma d lambda squared. Then I differentiated dx d sigma. So I want to calculate d by d lambda of dx mu d sigma, right? Now, I use the fact that d by d lambda is d sigma d lambda d by d sigma. OK? That's it. OK, great. OK, so if we have an action which is the integral of a Lagrangian times a time, and let me point out that when I took this action, you see, the way I wrote it here, I was actually using t as the parameter along a curve. That's fine, right? I have some curve in space-time. Space-time is ctx. The curve is doing something like this. As long as the curve doesn't double back on itself, as long as the curve is always advancing in t, then t is actually a fine parameter. I just use the value of t to tell me where I am in space. Okay, so let's think of the action that way. It's equally true in curved space time. As long as I've got as long as the curve is always advancing in the time coordinate, I just use the time coordinate as a parameter. So we have an action, which is the integral of a Lagrangian. The Lagrangian is, in general, a function of the coordinates and the velocity of the particle. And the way the action is defined is you impose boundary conditions. You insist that x of t passes through x initial at t initial and x final at t final. Okay? So when you use the action formalism, it's a little bit teleological. Okay? You see, the Newtonian picture of the world is that it's a clockwork machine. And you just give me x and x dot, and I just evolve them forward in time. Right? Hamilton realized, actually, the laws are much more elegant if I take a slightly teleological approach. I say, no, the way the world works is, given that I was here at one time, I've got to be there at another time. And the way I get there is by minimizing the action. Okay? And that was incredibly insightful, even if a little strange, because it sounds teleological, right? Why should I know where I'm going before I get there? But in fact, that precisely anticipated quantum mechanics. That's exactly how quantum mechanics works. Okay, in quantum mechanics, when you do Feynman path integral, you'll find this in the most obvious form. You say where you started, you say where you ended, and you work out the amplitude to get there. Okay, so in quantum mechanics, one really does consider the space of all possible final states, and each amplitude gets associated with the probability. The world is not a clockwork machine. It scans where it's going, and it decides which is the best option. Okay. Anyway, so this is how actions work. And then, as you well know, when I vary this action, this gives the classical equations of motion. Okay. So delta S equals zero gives the classical equations for x of t, where x of t has to satisfy the boundary conditions, and then you'll get some differential equations, which are the Lagrange equations. Now, something that's not very often or too often discussed is what Hamilton realized, which is that you should think about this as really a function of the initial time and final time coordinate, final time, final coordinate, where what you mean, evaluate this thing on, evaluated on the classical trajectory, this action is a function of x initial, t initial, x final, t final. And this is called Hamilton's principal function. Okay, so this turns out to be an extremely interesting function, that basically this function encodes all of classical mechanics. So I'm going to give you a little formal argument which will show you that this function automatically gives you the concepts of momentum and energy. In problems that have symmetry, this function reflects that symmetry. Okay, and then the symmetry, because the momentum and the energy can be determined from this function, the symmetries will tell you that they are conserved. Okay, so let's consider varying x initial, t initial, x final, t final. I want to know how this function changes as I change the initial and final position. And of course, when I vary these things, they're going to cause variations in the classical path. Okay, I'm going to call that x classical of t. This is a solution of the Lagrangian equation satisfying the right boundary conditions. And I'm going to use that solution to calculate the action. Now I want to know what is the variation in the classical action when I do such a variation of the initial and the final points. Well, just look at it. You can see that it's an integral. And so when I vary that integral, the first thing that happens is I get boundary terms, delta Tf times the Lagrangian at the final time, Lagrangian at t final, minus delta t initial times the Lagrangian t initial. Okay, that's just because it's an integral. And then what about the integrand? Well, that changes too. So I get dl dx delta x dt. And then I'm going to get integral dl dx dot, because the Lagrangian also depends on x dot, delta x dot dt. And I'm only going to work to first order in delta x and delta t. And so actually here, the integrals are just from ti to tf, because I already got my first order variation from the integrand. So what do I do with these? Well, you see, I'm allowed to use the classical equations of motion. So what I do here is integrate by parts. So this gives me dl dx dot delta x t initial t final plus minus d by dt of dl dx dot, but that cancels this term by the classical equations. Okay, plus terms vanishing by the classical equations. Okay, so let me just write that out. So that's equal to this term, delta T L. In fact, let me just combine them. It's equal to delta T L plus dl dx dot delta x t initial t final, where the notation means just work out everything at plus terms vanishing by the classical equations, which are dl dx equals d by dt dl dx dot. Right, now there's only one subtlety in the argument, which is if you think carefully, this quantity delta x means the variation at the initial and the final times. Okay, it is not equal to delta x initial, delta x final. The subtlety is that delta x final is equal to delta x of t final. This means the variation in the path plus x dot final delta t final. You see, because what I did is I changed the times and I changed the coordinates. Okay. Now, when I changed both of them, the path changed. The variation in the path has a different value at t final, but actually t final got changed. Okay, so to first order, what I have to do is to account for that fact is I get a little bit further than the variation did at t final. I get further by because I changed delta t final. Okay, and to first order, I can just use the velocity in the unvaried, the classical velocity with the original boundary conditions to get this change. Okay, so that's a small subtlety, but when you take that into account, then you get delta S equals delta T Lagrangian plus delta X. Now, this is really the delta X. This is not so delta X of T, I'll denote by the path. Okay, so wherever you see X of T, that's the path. Where you see no argument, it's really the X at the initial and the final points. So this is X minus X dot delta T dl dx dot T initial T final. Now let me see if I can do this manually. Middle. Okay, so why did I write this down? Well, this is equal to, this is equal to delta x dot p, where p is the canonical momentum, is dl dx dot, canonical momentum, minus delta t times the Hamiltonian, the Hamiltonian is defined, is usually defined to be p dot x dot minus l. And what we see is that this Hamilton principal function gives you the canonical momentum in the Hamiltonian as simply being the coefficient of the variation with respect to the final and initial positions and the final and the initial times. Okay, so it's all there in the action and in this classical action. And so you can say that, you know, if nobody thought of canonical momentum or Hamiltonian, but they knew about actions, well, the momentum and the Hamiltonian just sitting there. They're a direct consequence of the action. And so what this means is that the partial derivative of x classical with respect to the coordinate x final is equal to p final. That's the momentum. And the and there's a similar equation for p initial with a minus sign. The partial derivative of the classical action with respect to the time is minus the Hamiltonian. T final. Okay, now there's a one-line argument for Noether's theorem, okay, which I warn you is a bit slick. But Noether's theorem says the following. But Noether's theorem is very slick. Okay. And it took Noether to see it. Noether says the following. Imagine that the action has a symmetry. Right? For example, x going to x plus constant. We call that translation symmetry. If I could just move the system by a constant and the action doesn't change, well, the action has a translation symmetry. Well, then what you do is regard this as a variation. OK? It's just like the variation I did. Yeah?
Well, when we say the action has a symmetry, do we mean that it's completely invariant?
Absolutely.
Or does it just have to be,
it's got to be completely invariant. It's got to be somehow obvious from the action that if I took a trajectory and I just translated it, so for example, it was x dot squared. That obviously is invariant under this because this doesn't contribute. But more generally, if the action has a symmetry, you take x and transform it in some way, and the action is guaranteed to be the same, okay, then you can regard this as a variation. It's fine. It's a good variation. And so delta x final equals delta x initial equals the constant. Right? That's what you're going to get with that variation. And then what we know from here is that delta S classical, right, which we know is 0 because it was a symmetry, is equal to delta X P initial final. But the delta X initial and final are equal. And so this implies that P final equals P initial. Therefore, momentum is conserved. So I warned you it was slick. Okay? It's extremely powerful argument. Any symmetry of the action, you regard the symmetry transformation as a variation. And then you can see that the corresponding momentum has to be conserved. And this argument basically explains electric charge conservation, angular momentum conservation, all of these things, which all of the great physicists before Noether had completely failed to appreciate. Likewise, if the action, if t goes to t plus a constant is a symmetry, okay, if just going forward in time is a symmetry of the problem, regard that as a variation. Okay? And the same argument tells you, well, delta t initial and delta t final must be 0. It must be equal. And delta s was 0. So that means that h initial minus h final must be 0. Okay, then h final minus h initial equals 0. And this means that energy is conserved. Okay? And so Noether understood why energy is conserved. It's because space-time, the Minkowski metric, has time translation symmetry. And I think in your example class yesterday, you did isometries. Is that right? You did isometries of space-times? And maybe now you can see why they're so important. If there's an isometry under time shifts, if the metric is independent of t, that means this is a symmetry of g mu nu. Okay? That means that the action for a particle in such a space-time has that symmetry. That means that the Hamiltonian is conserved. And that Hamiltonian is the energy. Likewise, if the space-time has a translation symmetry, if that's an isometry of the space-time, you're guaranteed to have momentum conservation. And all these things are highly non-trivial, okay? And from these things, sort of everything else follows, the behavior of photons. You know, photons in an expanding universe, the wavelength of a photon doesn't remain the same. It gets stretched. Okay, but the momentum of a photon better be conserved. Why? Because the momentum is related to translation invariant, and the expanding universe is translation invariant. So all these things sort of follow from this. That's why I wanted to go through this. As far as I know, this isn't in any book that I know of, but it gives you direct means of identifying. You see, now it's trivial to identify the momentum and the energy, right? Because just take this action, the momentum is equal to dl dx dot. This is the Lagrangian, right? This is the whole Lagrangian. So I'm going to get minus mc squared, right? Minus mc squared. Differentiate this guy. I'm going to get another minus sign. I'm going to get a factor of 2 because there are two powers of x dot here. I'm going to get a half because of the square root. So I'm going to get dx dt in the numerator. And differentiating the square root, I get 1 over, I should have had a 1 over c squared because I differentiated c squared. And 1 over the square root, 1 minus dx dt over c squared. Okay, and of course that is equal to gamma mv. That's gamma mv. So that's the usual relativistic momentum.
Can that be dx dt squared?
Yeah, yes, thank you. Yeah. Okay, and similarly, if you work out the Hamiltonian, I'll leave that for you to do, px dot minus l, you'll find that's equal to gamma mc squared. And so that's the energy. Now, the beauty of doing it this way is that whatever interactions you put in, if you put in electromagnetic fields, if you put in other particles and collisions and all that, these principles guarantee you've got the right energy. Yeah, and you've got the right momentum.
So given just any arbitrary action, are you guaranteed the existence of a certain number of isometries? Like, that might be really complicated.
It all depends on the metric.
So there exist metrics,
yeah,
in which there are no isometries.
Mm-hmm. A general metric has no isometries at all. It's time-dependent. It's space-dependent. Roughly speaking, you could say that's because the space-time is full of gravitational waves. And those are, you know, those can transfer energy back and forth with anything traveling through the space-time. So it's only when the space-time has a lot of symmetry that you get conserved quantities. So it's a kind of nice thought that, you know, when you're measuring energy conservation, what you're really doing is you're seeing how beautiful the universe is. It's really symmetrical. The geometry of the universe has these manifestations in conservation laws. And before NERSA, these were really mysterious. I mean, people kind of took them on as principles. They didn't really understand why is energy conserved, why is momentum, why is angular momentum conserved. They knew in practice, you know, that if you put in a particle in a potential which depends on x, obviously it's going to slosh back and forth, so the momentum isn't conserved. And that's another form. But you see, they knew also that if you have two particles with a force between them, the total momentum is conserved, right? Even though they interact, the total momentum is conserved. And that was explained as a sort of balance between the force from the one on the other is the same as the force from the other on the one, and therefore the total momentum is conserved as a cancellation. That really wasn't right. I mean, that was Newton's third law, action equals minus reaction, and so it's actually wrong for magnetic fields. It's just not true that magnetic forces are perpendicular to the velocity, and this action reaction is just wrong. But when you formulate things this way, you see that providing you have a symmetry in the space-time, you get conservation laws. Yeah.
So, you know, don't necessarily have these symmetries. Is it the case that energy and momentum are only locally conserved?
Say again. In
since if general metrics don't actually have these symmetries,
right,
the case that energy and momentum are just actually locally conserved.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. You know, one of the, I guess the ultimate example of that is the dark energy, right? So the dark energy has a fixed energy density per unit volume, but the volume of the universe is growing exponentially. So the total energy, meaning density times volume, is growing exponentially in the universe. This energy is definitely not conserved on big scales. Energy is only conserved locally. And as you say, that's because locally the metric is Minkowski-like.
So where does the energy come from?
Energy is symmetry. So just think energy. If I talk about energy, I better be sure what symmetry I'm talking about. If I haven't got a symmetry, talking about energy.
With the expanding universe, you've got an energy density.
Right.
But as the universe expands, there's more energy available. But what's fueling
that? Well, you'll often see people write this in popular books as gravitational potential energy is negative, and this compensates for the expansion of the energy. If you like, look at the Friedman equation. We'll actually do that on Friday. But the Friedman equation is kind of a balance between kinetic and potential energy. And you can sort of say that as the universe expands, there's a balance between kinetic energy and potential energy. And the sum of them are zero, actually. So even though we get more and more potential energy, we also get more and more kinetic energy. And the two cancel. So that's one way of explaining it. But it's not a very good way. I would say if you don't have a symmetry, don't talk about energy. Okay, so that was a bit of a digression. I hope you enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. Unfortunately, it slowed us down, as usual. So I guess now we have to do the nuts and bolts work. Let's try and do that now, the last thing in the lecture. Let's try and take this action and see that we get the geodesic equation.
Before we start, could you repeat one more time how the equivalence principle lets you take that action?
Right. Equivalence principle just means literally this. That's all it means. Write down all your laws of physics in flat space-time. You're going to have to use eta to make them special relativistic invariant, right? Because we wrote the Maxwell equations like this. And then we had the other one, the d alpha f beta gamma cycled equals zero. And then we noticed we had the lowered and the upper indices. So we had to define, the upper guy was defined using eta. It was a minus mu naught, I think. Okay, so those were the Maxwell equations. And we had to have an eta to define them. So the whole game of the equivalence principle is replace eta with g. That's it. It's the entire meaning of the equivalence principle. Now, this is not an unambiguous procedure, okay? Okay, this is really not unambiguous. It's somewhat ambiguous. The reason is that if I had these laws in space-time, flat space-time, which involve the metric, okay, I can translate them into curved space-time by changing the metric to g. However, it might be that the true laws have extra things in them. You see, this equivalence principle, what about... Well, we'll deal with this next lecture, but the Ricci curvature, the curvature of space-time, maybe the true laws do involve the curvature of space-time. You just won't see them in the special relativistic forms. All those terms are zero. They might be there. So it means when you lift them, you actually miss certain terms, which might really be there. Terms involving the curvature of space-time, because that involves second derivatives of the metric. You're just not going to see them in flat space. So in a local frame, a local region of space-time, those terms are going to be unimportant. But nevertheless, globally, there may be things that you miss through the equivalence principle. Yeah?
Is doing this transformation the same as saying acceleration is the same as gravity?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think so. Yeah, I think so. Let me think about it. It's always confusing. I always have to think these things from the beginning. But yes, I would say yes. My gut feeling is yes. But I can't justify it immediately. So yes, I think the fact that you can, another way of saying it, is that you can get rid of gravity. Yeah, I guess David kind of partly did this. If you have one particle falling in a gravitational field, this is completely equivalent to viewing this as, this is the viewpoint of somebody sitting on Earth, is the particle is falling in a gravitational field. But the viewpoint of somebody falling with the particle is that the particle's in free fall and there is no gravity. Okay, so that is saying that basically the laws of physics with, so gravity I would mean some non-trivial metric, some metric that isn't flat. But actually I can change coordinates to one in which it's flat. And indeed, when you do that, you would create some apparent acceleration in the coordinate system in which it's flat. We can try and do that exercise. I think it's a good exercise. In fact, I think you've kind of done it, right? David sort of did it. You have a phi which has a gradient, and therefore you have a Newtonian potential with some gradient, and then you can eliminate it using a coordinate transformation. That coordinate transformation will produce acceleration. But the thing which you cannot describe in that point of view is if I've got two particles falling towards the Earth, well, imagine I drop them parallel, okay, so I make sure their velocities are parallel. I drop them, of course, they're going to fall towards each other because they're both going to be attracted by, let's put the center of the Earth there. So, you know, this guy is going to, or maybe let me rephrase it. Say I have a point mass, gravitational mass, and I send in two particles parallel. As they approach it, this guy's going to get bent that way, and this guy's going to get bent the other way, right? And that bending, the relative bending, you will never mimic with an accelerated frame. And so this actually is called a geodesic deviation, and we'll do it next time. It's proportional to the Riemann tensor. When the Riemann tensor or the second derivative of the metric are non-zero, paths bend towards each other. And you cannot eliminate that with a coordinate transformation. And so the second derivatives of the metric really curve the geodesics and can force them to collide. And that's real curvature, which cannot be eliminated with a coordinate transformation. Okay, any other? Oh, I was going to do the geodesic equation. Let's just do that quickly. So let's start off with this action and vary it. And I'm going to leave it with a completely general parameterization, right? So that lambda was arbitrary. Right? As long as it's a good parameter along the curve, it was arbitrary, because the two d lambdas here inside the square root cancel with the d lambda there. So if you change lambda to any other parameter, it's the same action. Let's vary it. Okay, so S equals minus mc integral root minus g mu nu dx. So I'm going to introduce some notation. X mu prime, x nu prime, d lambda, okay, where x mu prime is dx mu d lambda, just to make life easier. So what is the variation of the action? Well, it's minus mc. Now I've got to vary this square root. This g mu is really evaluated at x. It's got to be evaluated on the at x of lambda. So when I vary x, I've got to vary this guy as well. So I'm going to get one half, because it's a square root, one over the square root, and then the variation of everything inside the square root. So I'm going to get minus g mu nu comma lambda delta x lambda. That's from varying this guy. Okay, I take the partial derivative of g with respect to x lambda and multiply by delta x lambda. So I'm just saying that the variation of a function of x is equals to delta x times df dx. So that's the first term. And then the second term, there are two of them, so twice, because the x prime comes twice, g mu nu delta x prime mu x nu. Okay. And now what we do in variational principles is we, that was x prime nu. Two, because I had to vary this guy, and the metric symmetric. Now, in variational principles, you just integrate by parts, right, to express everything as something times delta x. But before we do that, let's notice that, yeah, you're right, I left out some terms. There's a x prime mu, x prime nu, right? These two things are also there. And of course, I've got a d lambda up here. OK, now let's notice that x mu dot, which is dx mu d tau, is equal to x mu prime. So this is dx d lambda. I'll just write this out explicitly. Dx mu d lambda 1 over square root minus g mu nu x prime nu. I've got this 1 over square root here, right? And you can ask, what does it really mean, this 1 over square root? Well, the 1 over square root is precisely the transformation between proper time and lambda. Now, as usual, I think I should have C's in there just to get the dimensions right. I hope that's correct. And so basically, this is minus MC. So now what we want to do is to convert all these lambda derivatives into dots, proper time derivatives. So here I've got two lambda derivatives in the denominator, two d lambdas in the denominator, one in the numerator. And then I've got this conversion factor, okay? So one extra conversion factor will convert all of these into taus. So this becomes mc squared 1 half d tau minus g mu nu comma lambda delta x lambda x dot nu minus 2 g mu nu delta x dot nu. You see, I did this conversion before integrating by parts, because I kind of know the answer, right? But it's justified, because it doesn't really make sense to integrate by parts in lambda. What's lambda? Lambda's not fundamental, some arbitrary parameterization. Let's not integrate by parts in lambda. Let's integrate by parts in tau, because that's a good thing, right? That is the proper time. You see, this d tau, which is the stuff in the denominator, that's completely independent of parameterization. The d lambdas cancel in d tau. Right? So don't integrate by parts in lambda, integrate by parts in tau, because that's an invariant thing. It's a coordinate invariant thing. So now we're ready to integrate by parts. And so we'll say this is proportional to integral d tau minus g mu nu, comma lambda x dot mu x dot nu. Integrate by parts here, I'm going to get a plus 2 g mu nu x dot nu. Let's relabel the indices. So here I had a delta x lambda. So let me relabel this as a lambda and that as a lambda. So I'm going to end up with a delta x lambda. So this is plus 2 g lambda nu x dot nu dotted, the whole thing dotted, times delta x lambda outside everything. And so let's write that out again. Manual, which one are we? Front. This is all multiplied by delta x lambda, it equals 0. And so this implies that g mu nu x dot nu dot equals 1 half g mu nu comma lambda that's a lambda here okay yeah
you throw out the boundary term
Yes, when you work out the classical equations of motion, the definition of the variational problem is that you fix the boundary, you fix delta x to be zero on the boundary. And so just ignore the boundary term. Okay, so here what I have, differentiating this, I will get, differentiating this, I'm going to get g lambda mu comma mu x dot nu. That's differentiating the g. So I take the partial derivative of g with respect to x mu, and then dx mu d tau. Then I differentiate this guy plus g mu nu x double dot nu equals 1 half g mu nu comma lambda x dot nu. Pull all of this over to the right-hand side, and we get x double dot mu equals minus gamma mu, or let's write it as a Christoffel symbol, just to be mu nu lambda x dot lambda. Okay, so remember this Christoffel symbol, mu nu lambda is equal to 1 half g mu alpha g nu alpha comma lambda plus g lambda alpha comma nu minus g mu lambda comma alpha. So this term, this last term, is giving me the right-hand side term. And this term is the sum of these first two terms. And because I'm contracting with x dot nu x dot lambda, these two terms are identical because they are symmetric or alpha. Actually, let me just try and make it correspond a little better. Yeah, because I'm contracting with the velocities. And so we get x double dot mu plus gamma plus mu nu lambda x dot lambda equals 0. So we get the geodesic equation. Yeah?
So if I see, for example, for a sphere of the plane, the geodesics are basically
great circles. Great circles. Geodesics are great circles.
Can I always use geodesics to define orthogonal coordinates? In my manifold, because if I can do so, then
You can always define orthogonal frames everywhere, but you want to define global orthogonal frames. I guess that's what you want to do. You want to define the same frame everywhere. Is that what you want to do?
Or locally, I mean.
Well, you can always do it locally. You don't.
Right, so whenever I have the trajectory of a particle, right, which is a geodesic, I can always align that trajectory with a coordinate that I want?
Yes, absolutely. So this is often a very useful idea. You think about, they're called free fall coordinates. Because a particle just moving in space-time with no forces will satisfy the geodesic equation, okay? So you can literally think physically that I, at a certain time, moment of time, let's put some clocks in space-time, right? So we pick some surface, throw down some clocks, and then they fall. And they might go around the Earth or whatever they do, but they're all carrying the time. And so at every point in space-time, I'll have a clock if I make them dense enough, right? And the so then you would say my coordinates x are labeled by the clocks. So a given clock specifies the coordinate. Its initial coordinates actually are the space coordinates. And the time coordinates are the time measured by the clock. So wherever, if the space-time is dense with these clocks, I just look at the nearest clock and it'll tell me what my position is and what the time is. Those are called synchronous coordinates. And they are defined by freely falling particles. The thing that goes wrong with them, you can see, because if I set up a bunch of clocks and they fall towards the sun, okay, then as they go to the other side, they're going to cross. Generically, their trajectories will cross. And that means that at a given point in space-time, I've got two clocks, and I don't know what the time is anymore. Which one should I use? And that's a sign that's a bad coordinate system. Okay, so synchronous coordinates are really useful, especially in cosmology, but they have this problem that the coordinate system, the lines of the coordinate system tend to cross. And then you have to throw them away and pick some new coordinates. So the general rule of life in GR or in gauge theories or whatever you do, there is no one gauge, there's no one coordinate system which is valid in all circumstances. So you have to typically pick some coordinates that are good for the problem you're using. And then at some point, those coordinates will go bad. And you have to change coordinates to some other coordinates which remain good. And
so, I mean, you're allowed to change your coordinates because you want that your physics is independent of your
coordinates. Exactly.
Right? But then if I'm... But do you have coordinates that are... I mean, you have... Yeah, you choose two different coordinate frames, right? You're observing different things, and you're saying that in one coordinate frame, you have singularities like this.
Yes.
Right? And you have to change a coordinate frame.
Absolutely.
So that's
typical.
Of me not being clever enough of choosing
the right coordinates. Exactly.
It's not a problem of physics at all.
Not at all. Not at all. So this happens again and again and again. When we study the black hole, we'll see that the obvious coordinates are actually very bad the moment you fall into the black hole. But then you can change coordinates to good coordinates that are valid as you fall through. And you see, the coordinates, the relationship between coordinates are just something you use to do calculations. Any physical process, so if I really describe my observation in physical terms, like I detected a photon hitting my eye with a wavelength of x in units of the atomic size. So if I really define things precisely in terms of physical quantities that were measured, the coordinate system is completely irrelevant. Okay, so for example, the number of oscillations of a laser beam, you know, it's an integer between, say, two moments of time. That's not going to change with the changing of coordinates. And so providing you're careful to phrase everything you discuss in terms of physical interactions of particles, the coordinate system is irrelevant.
But if I take it, for example, coordinate system...
Or any, I shouldn't say that. I should say any coordinate system will be equally good for calculating with, providing it's a good one.
Yeah, So let's say you have a coordinate system where you have a singularity, but that you can remove it by making another
coordinate transformation. That's right.
So,
that's typical.
These two coordinate systems are basically two different reference frames from which I'm describing the same phenomenon, right?
Yes, that's
so,
right. That's what we mean by reference frame.
Right. So if I'm in this reference frame where I chose these coordinates that are ill-defined at a point, how can I mean, there is a physical interpretation for that singularity?
Right. No, there isn't. There isn't. So it's this picture. You see, you have these two coordinate systems. Let's think of the x and x prime. And as long as they are both good, they have to agree. So in this overlap region, they have to agree. But the x coordinates may be good here, where the x prime totally fail. I just can't use the x prime coordinates if I'm over here. And likewise over here, vice versa. And this is totally generic. Is that for any coordinate system you define, I guarantee I can find you a physical problem in which that coordinate system will fail. Okay? So many people have tried to say, you know, maybe there's one preferred coordinate system, and let's just formulate physics in that system and forget about all these different coordinate systems. And that never works. So. And it's essentially because the coordinates themselves are just a tool we use to conceptualize reality. You shouldn't even think about a reference frame as being a real thing. The reference frame is really an artifact of the observer who needs to describe what's going on around them.
Right.
That's what the reference frame is. It's not a property of the world. It's just something we use to draw lines. You know, we have this world, this curved world, and we draw lines on it, and we call them our coordinates. But the way we drew the lines is totally arbitrary.
When you say your coordinate system fails, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, I'll give you an example. We did one with a sphere, right? So in the sphere, we had this metric, d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. And if I ask you, what is the point theta equals zero? Well, that's the North Pole. It's just like every other point. Nothing wrong at the North Pole. But in this coordinate system, the coordinate system totally fails because the coordinate system is not one-to-one at that point. One point on the manifold corresponds to many values of phi. All values from 0 to 2 pi label the same point at theta equals 0. So you could immediately see there's a really bad coordinate system. And then if you look at the metric in that coordinate system, you see it's degenerate at that point because theta is 0. So this term vanishes. So your metric is a matrix which can't be inverted. The metric is this. And so it's not invertible. There's no inverse metric. So bang goes all your attempts to write down equations in this coordinate system. You haven't got an inverse. And so obviously what you do is you say, well, that was a really bad coordinate system. So let me change to another one which has bad points on the equator. Then I can describe what happened at the North Pole. Sorry. Okay.